And this is The Point here on CAI. I'm Eve Zukov. It's Friday, March 15th. This is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Brian Angles, Jason Graziadei of the Nantucket Current, Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette, Anastasia Lennon of the New Bedford Light, Sophie Mann Shafir of the Provincetown Independent, and we'll hear from CAI's State House correspondent Katie Lannon. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. The project to replace the Bourne and Sagamore bridges has been awarded partial funding. It comes in a federal spending bill signed by President Biden, and it's still far from the full estimated cost, but it could signal future federal support. CAI's Jeanette Barnes has details, and she joins us now. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Eve.
Jeanette, tell us about this money. I understand it's $350 million. How did this come about?
Well, this is money that was requested by our congressional delegation and supported by President Biden as well, but it still had to be negotiated as part of this package of spending bills that passed the Senate Friday night, right before the deadline for a partial government shutdown. President Biden then signed the package on Saturday. And as you said, it's $350 million designated to go toward the bridge project. It's coming through the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which owns the bridges. So Congress wrote this explanatory statement that's separate from the spending bill and kind of itemizes where it intends for the money to go. And that document is what specifies the bridge project. This money is only a small part of the estimate, $4.5 billion for the Bourne and Sagamore bridges combined. But funding is starting to add up now from a few different sources. And the support that we saw for this bill could bode well for future federal grants from the executive branch that actually could be much larger than the money we reported this week. The state and Army Corps have applied for a Federal Highway Administration grant that's worth more than $1 billion. This project is certainly expensive. Senator Elizabeth Warren told me this week that the bridges are the most expensive bridge project that she knows about that is asking for so much federal funding.
Which is part of why there's kind of this piecemeal approach.
Right.
Can you give us a quick summary of how much money the bridge project has received so far and what's coming up?
Sure. The state and Army Corps have already received two smaller federal grants totaling $372 million. So let's do some quick math. Governor Healey put $262 million in her capital plan. If you add those to the new money from the spending bill, you have almost $1 billion. And then if they also receive that upcoming highway grant I just mentioned, which is called the Bridge Investment Program grant, then the total of those major funding sources would be almost $2 billion. And that's just shy of the estimate for the first bridge to be built, which is going to be the Sagamore Bridge.
Right. What's the status of the Sagamore project? Has the state gone any further with the actual planning of it?
Well, the state is going out to bid for a design build team. The state highway administrator, Jonathan Gulliver, told me in December that it will most likely be a team of companies bidding together because the project is so large, it would be hard for one firm to do both the design and the construction. He said it would take a few months to put together those bid documents, but the overall process to award that contract should take about 2 years. And that would be just for the Sagamore. But during that same 2 year period, the environmental permitting process is going to be happening, and the permitting will be for both bridges at once.
Okay. What kind of reaction did you hear in the community to the bridges getting at least this, $350 million in the spending package?
Yes. Well, I talked with Marie Oliva, who's the CEO of the Cape Cod Canal Region Chamber of Commerce. She was very happy to hear about it. She says things are going in the right direction, but she's not letting anyone off the hook, really, though. Mm-hmm. She says that this project does need to get the rest of that money. Senator Warren, when I talked with her, she, of course, was very pleased as well. And she gave a little shout out to people in the community who wrote letters to her about this. She said she got letters from dozens of people and that really helped her make the case for support.
Okay. Well, let's turn to some news on offshore wind now. Announced just yesterday, South Fork Wind has finished construction with power being sent to New York. This project is only 21 miles south of Martha's Vineyard. Jeanette, tell us about this project.
Yes. So this is a New York project, as you said, but it's geographically actually closer to the vineyard than to Long Island. It is the largest offshore wind farm to be completed since the Block Island wind farm opened in 2016. Block Island has 5 turbines. They're much lower capacity turbines. It really was a different era. But South Fork has 12 turbines, and the construction of those is now complete, although not all of the turbines are operating yet. It's a smaller project than Vineyard Wind. Vineyard Wind will have 62 turbines. But this really is still a moment worth noting. You know, the offshore wind developers have acknowledged that the process of opening these projects is like a series of announcements and not one big ta-da moment because there's so much startup testing to do to get each and every piece of that electrical equipment running. But if finishing your construction of turbines is somewhat of a ta-da moment, then this is it for South Fork Wind. So Vineyard Wind is still working toward that. But again, they have a much bigger project to install.
Right. What is the status right now of Vineyard Wind? Do we have any updates?
Well, we know at least 5 turbines are sending electricity to the grid. In early February, they had 8 turbines installed, and it's more now, reportedly at least 10. I've also heard an unconfirmed number that was a little higher than that. In terms of the timeline to finish all 62, company executives have said previously that they were targeting the end of this year. But the CEO of Avangrid, one of the parent companies, told Commonwealth Beacon recently that he's not concerned about the exact dates. He says this is really about the big picture, and it's not productive to worry about, you know, whether it's the end of this year or the beginning of next year. I think a lot of people can relate to the idea that when you're dealing with weather, with multiple contractors and such, that setting a deadline that far ahead is difficult. So.
And when you asked, too, what was the answer when you asked?
Well, this week when I asked, they did not reply to my request. So we had talked about some other things, but they did not reply to that particular point. And from the interview in Commonwealth, my guess is that they're probably going to be sort of toning down that continual focus on the actual deadline.
Okay. Well, you wrote another story this week about offshore wind. It has to do with complaints that there are bright red lights on the turbines at Vineyard Wind staying on all night long. What is happening with that?
Yes, people are saying they're seeing a line of bright red lights on the turbines and that those lights are on all night long. One person described it as like looking out at a fence. And we know Vineyard Wind promised to use a lighting system that would only turn on those bright red aviation lights when there are aircraft in the area. So I asked Vineyard Wind about this, and really it is a pretty simple explanation. Basically, this lighting system that they're planning to use that uses radar to detect aircraft and turn the lights on and off, it's called an aircraft detection lighting system. But it won't be operating until the whole project is complete. So again, we're looking at that timeline toward the end of the year or later. And until then, those red lights do have to be on all the time at night for safety reasons, because the automatic system isn't working. So or isn't ready to work. So it's a wait and see game on that. The plan is still to have those lights stay off most of the time, unless there's an aircraft in the area. I should say there are other lights on the turbines, but those are for marine navigation. They're closer to the water. They're not as bright. And those are not expected to be visible from shore.
Okay, got it. Well, Jeanette, before you go, I'd love to kind of switch chairs here, if you will, in the studio. I am going to resume my usual role as a reporter rather than a host, and talk about a few more stories.
Yes, I'd be happy to do that.
Good. Okay, so this week I covered news that the state issued a shellfish closure in parts of Buzzards Bay, effective immediately. It has to do with public health concerns.
Right. This closure is around an outflow pipe from the New Bedford and Fairhaven wastewater treatment plant. What is the concern?
Well, the concern has to do with just kind of the nature of shellfish, actually. As filter feeders, bivalve shellfish are highly vulnerable to contamination from polluted waters, which can can create health issues if consumed. You know, because municipal waste, even treated municipal waste, has a fair amount of E. coli in it, basically it can lead to a whole bunch of gastrointestinal issues. So state officials said there's nothing specifically wrong with this wastewater treatment plant or its treated water, that outflow. There's just a need for a larger buffer zone between the outflow and where shellfish are being grown and harvested. And that's just because of a growing population on the South Coast with more people flushing more toilets.
All right. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration originally pushed the state to close the majority of Buzzards Bay to shellfishing, but the state decided not to take it to that level, to do it as drastically. Why not?
Well, preliminary modeling results found that over 103,000 acres of Buzzards Bay could need to be reclassified as prohibited to comply with the federal the FDA's National Shellfish Sanitation Program. But in an interim plan, the Division of Marine Fisheries from the state, they opted to issue an 82% smaller closure, and they only expanded the prohibited safety zone around the wastewater treatment outfall by 11,000 acres or so. They also reclassified the surrounding areas of that in Buzzards Bay as conditionally approved or open to harvest except under emergency conditions like sewage overflows, because basically DMF, they wanted to minimize impacts to local shellfish farms that don't have a history of causing illness.
But inside that closure area, how many shellfishermen will be affected?
Well, according to officials, state officials, the closure will impact some recreational shellfishermen. The city of New Bedford, which has hoped to open up an aquaculture industry within the Clark's Cove area. And there are two quahog harvesters who really have no recourse here, but they will lose a significant portion of their harvesting area. They each harvested less than $20,000 worth of quahogs in that closure area. But state officials say, you know, to be clear, we're not closing all the area that were fished. We're just closing a portion of the area. There are other spots that they will have to move to. And additional testing, if there's additional testing that proves that this closure area can be smaller, officials will kind of move to that. Now, again, all of this, the prohibited area, the kind of provisional area, it's all an interim plan. So to ensure that state officials are on top of public health concerns, the DMF has said they will expand water quality monitoring and bacterial and viral testing of shellfish tissue kind of all around the area. And if the shellfish outside the closure are positive for high viral load, this would be back to what they called worst case scenario, a major closure over 103,000 acres.
It's a good reminder of how interconnected things are in the marine environment, which leads us to another story you reported this week about North Atlantic right whales being more affected by entanglements in rope and fishing gear than previously thought, even more so, right? Yeah. Tell us about the latest study on this.
Yeah, this study was led by an Australian researcher who analyzed how entanglements are impacting female whales' survival and the likelihood that they'll reproduce. And basically, they found that if a right whale female had no entanglements, the chance of her becoming a breeder in the population is only about 20%. It's very low, actually. Individuals with severe entanglements, their chances go down to 14%. But if a female had just a minor entanglement, her chances of reproducing go down to just 11%.
Mm. We know you will be following right whales and many other things for us.
Yes, I will. And Jeanette, we are passing the mic here between us for the last time because Steve Junker will be back next week. But I want to thank you so much for doing this. Jeanette Barnes, CAI reporter.
Thank you, Eve.
We are going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll be speaking with Jason Graziadei from the Nantucket Current. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Eve Zuckoff. A beachfront home on Nantucket has sold for just $600,000. A bargain, considering last year's median sale price was just under $3 million. The only catch? It's not clear how long it will last on a fast-eroding shoreline. Jason Graziadei from the Nantucket Current has this story. Jason, thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Okay, Jason, describe this house, how it's situated, and what the risk level is here.
Yeah, so it's a pretty modest house by, Nantucket beachfront standards. This is located on Sheep Pond Road on the island's southwest shoreline. And it is right up against the waves now. It's lost about 30, maybe 40 feet over the last year to erosion. And Sheep Pond Road, many people on the island are familiar with this. It's been an erosion hotspot for years. A number of houses have been moved, have been lost to the waves and gone over the bluff. One in the fall, you had a house that was condemned and then demolished by the homeowners due to erosion. So those are the risks on the South Shore, especially along Sheep Pond Road.
And you talked to the buyer who got kind of a deal by some standards. The house was originally listed at $2.2 million. Like, who is this person and how does he think about these risks to the house that you've just laid out?
Yeah, exactly. When we saw this sale come across, you say, $600,000, it's a lot for Nantucket, as you said at the open. That would probably be the lowest price for any single family home that you're going to see. So immediately caught our eye. And then when you see the pictures and understand the location, you say, okay, well, that makes sense because there's a huge amount of risk here. You don't know how long this house is gonna make it. So we did. We reached out to the buyer, Brendan Madigan, and talked to him about this purchase. And, first question, why? He had a long connection to Nantucket. He's from Woods Hole and had sort of, been going to Nantucket on vacations with his family and had been looking at real estate. He's in the real estate business and had his eye on this property, given its sort of unique situation. And then, as you said, the asking price over the span of a couple months went from $2.2 million all the way down to $600,000. So a combination of both the erosion happening and the risk to this property, as well as a very motivated seller. And we also talked to the listing broker who said, we had a lot of conversations between her and the seller and said, what can we price this at to sell this now? So that's how that price dropped. And the buyer, Brendan Madigan, was the first in with an offer in writing, and they took it. So, we talked to him. He said, I understand the risks. I know it's a gamble. If I get, a number of years out of this with my family, I think I'll be pretty happy. But he's under no illusions. He told us, I know what the trends are. Climate change is real. Sea level rise is real. But he's going into it with his eyes wide open.
I want to talk about one more story, but first I just have to ask you, because when I read this story, it just made me wonder, and I saw a little bit of online criticism about it. Did he have anything to say about the fact that when this house goes in the drink, like the refrigerants, the cleaning supplies, the fuel oil, the sheer amount of debris that will come from this house into the environment will be everyone's problem? Just quickly here, did he have anything to say about that?
Yeah, I mean, he talked about some things that he's going to do to forestall, those types of issues, moving the septic tank on the property, moving some of the utilities, doing everything he can, short of the type of erosion control measures that we see on the eastern side of the island, which he said he's, you won't see him in front of the Conservation Commission asking for those types of things. But I think the local regulatory authorities here do keep their eyes on these properties regularly. And when it becomes pretty clear, you do have things like emergency demolition orders to avoid the situation, exactly what you said, having it just topple over the bluff and into the ocean. So to remove these houses before they go in, that has happened. It did happen on Sheep Pond Road, in fact, just last fall. So we'll see what happens here, and definitely we'll be keeping an eye on this property.
Okay, and the next minute that we've got left here, Jason, I want to keep talking about money, but not spending it, winning it. A man hit $1 million scratch ticket after purchasing it at the Old South Diner. What can you tell us about this man?
Yeah, so, we got word from the lottery that we had $1 million scratch ticket winner on Nantucket. Of course, everyone's wondering who it is. Do they know him? Turns out the man is Jose Fontanez. He's a Boston resident, but his girlfriend lives here on the island. So he's a regular at the Old South Market, Old South Diner, where this ticket was sold and hit the $1 million prize, told the lottery that, you know, he's going to be buying a house with that, maybe not on Nantucket, but even though that's a huge prize. But we'll see, you know, where he ends up with that. But it was, you know, people were very happy for him and his girlfriend here on the island.
That's Jason Graziadei from the Nantucket Current. Jason, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
All right, island hopping now. Edgartown residents will soon vote on regulations that would cap how many parties a homeowner can throw at their property. Ethan Genter of the Martha's Vineyard Gazette reported this story and joins us now. Hi, Ethan.
Good morning, Eve.
So this proposed bylaw is the first of its kind on the island. Walk us through the specifics of it.
Sure. So what this would do is limit parties of or any kind of gathering, really, of 50 or more people at a private residence to 2 per month and no more than 5 per year.
And there are exceptions and consequences, right?
Yeah, so what you can get, you can hold more than those if you get a special permit from the select board over here in Edgartown. And, you know, if you are found to be having a couple more gatherings than you're supposed to, it's going to result in maybe a $300 fine. It could be a court injunction. Yeah, those are kind of some of the penalties they've got there.
Okay. This effort to party poop was sparked by some events this summer. What is the backstory?
Yeah, so this all came about, this kind of really sparked last year. I mean, there's kind of been rumblings of commercial operations in residential areas with Airbnb, but this kind of really all came to the fore last year. There was a home in Edgartown that is owned by the owner of a whiskey company. They were throwing kind of events with the whiskey company, and they were pretty large events. Kind of the one that really stuck in people's minds was there was one time where, you know, cars kind of all lined up on the road to go to this event. There was regular people stopping traffic so people could cross the street to get to this party. But even neighbors, just in general, kind of saying, you know, we're hearing noise all the time. There's this kind of supposedly commercial operation going on in our neighborhood here, which really sparked a lot of people's concerns about this kind of continuing.
Okay. And this proposed bylaw is set to go before Edgartown voters at town meeting on April 9th. How are locals responding so far?
Yeah, there's a couple different camps. Obviously, there's neighbors who are, at first, when this was first proposed, an earlier draft of this, they weren't so happy. They wanted something a little more stringent. Then on the other end, there's people saying, you know, it's kind of a slippery slope if you start telling people, you know, you can't have 50 friends over at your home. The select board, to try and in their attempt to try and thread that needle, they said, you know, if you have large events, you know, how many weddings are you going to host at your house? You know, how many daughters are you going to marry off every year? If you're not causing any issues, they say we can give you a permit if it's not really any problem. So I'm sure it'll cause a lot of discussion at town meeting. It's been a couple feisty select board meetings talking about it.
Okay. Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette, thank you.
Yep. Take care.
The state pier in New Bedford could get a major facelift. Bidders are pushing for a more pedestrian-friendly, mixed-use vision that could even include a seafood auction house. Anastasia Lennon of the New Bedford Light is here to talk about development dreams. Hi, Anastasia.
Hi, Eve.
Can you give us some mental image of what the state pier could turn into with this proposal that Mass Development is currently looking at?
Yeah, so it's really looking to fulfill a vision that the mayor and the city have been pushing for, which is just to better integrate the working waterfront, which some parts are much more industrial, with the city. And so, as you noted, making it more pedestrian friendly, making it a place where people can see the offloading of the fishing vessels, they can eat and dine at a restaurant, they can maybe do some shopping. And so that'd be much different than what we have right now, which is you have, you know, the Sea Street Ferry Terminal and and Cuttyhunk, but it's mostly just an open parking lot, lots of gray concrete. So the vision is really to make it a place that people are going to want to come visit and spend some time.
Right. This 6,500 square foot restaurant, operations hub for offshore wind. I mean, it's an 8-acre parcel. There's a lot of options. What happens next here?
Yep. So this has actually been going on a while for this process. So Mass Development is a quasi-state agency, and they're reviewing bids. They previously selected a group that have since submitted proposals again. It's a bunch of local people, and they're sort of submitting the same ideas, which would be, as we mentioned, offshore wind hub, retail space, restaurant. And so Mass Development's reviewing these bids and proposals that were due last month, and they expect to have some decision this spring. There might also be some public forums or sessions where people could give feedback or comments, but the nature of that is still a bit unclear, which state officials have criticized, wanting the process to be a bit more transparent as the agency finalizes their review and decisions.
Yeah, this transparency issue is interesting here in this process of redevelopment. Can you give us a little bit more of a sense of that history and how it's led to lingering concerns at this stage?
Yeah, so, you know, an argument that one of the vocal critics, Representative Bill Strauss, makes is this is a public asset here. This is a piece of property that belongs to the people, and so they should have input on how it's used and selected. And an issue he highlighted with the last round was Mass Development ultimately, after they provisionally accepted this group, they had then determined, actually, we can't go forward with this. It requires too much public investment. The things you propose are in violation of certain statutes and rules of how you can use this property. So the argument that Strauss and others make is transparency would not only, be warranted because it's a public it's a public site, but also it could allow feedback that might prevent sort of a repeat of what happened of presenting ideas that ultimately aren't feasible. They just really want it to be a more open process to make sure, you know, all the boxes are checked and that this vision that's picked is something that is feasible and something that the community would want to see.
Mm. Okay, well, let's talk about one more infrastructure story before you go. State officials are solidifying plans to replace the New Bedford-Fairhaven Bridge, but there are concerns about how the proposed design could impact the region's offshore wind industry. Can you explain the design and why there are concerns here?
Yeah, so right now we have this swing bridge that on the hour every day it opens and allows fishing vessels to pass through because otherwise they wouldn't be able to. There's height restrictions with this bridge. And so this bridge is deemed by the state as functionally obsolete. It requires constant repairs and maintenance. And so they want to put in a new one. And they're going forward possibly with a vertical lift bridge. So that's a bridge that will just lift really high up. But what the city's concerned about is that the height it would reach is just still too low for the clearance required for major offshore wind vessels. And, Mayor Mitchell has been pushing offshore wind and New Bedford as serving now and in the future as a hub of the offshore wind industry. And we don't fully know where that industry is going. The parts are growing in size constantly, but there's hope that the port will continue to serve and maybe grow in how it supports this industry.
Mm. Now, I know state officials didn't respond to the New Bedford Light's request for comment about kind of the concerns, but what have they said generally about the design and why they think it's the one?
Yeah, so part of it is just considerations of the time it would take to rebuild and construct a new bridge. They say vertical lift would take the least amount of time, so it would be a shorter interruption to people and getting between areas and the islands and also just cost. And so they just see it as the most effective solution. They haven't gone out and said, oh, we're definitely pulling these other options off the table, but it's more a consideration, they say, of just interruptions and time to get this work done as this being the more feasible option.
Mm. Anastasia Lennon from the New Bedford Light, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Eve.
We are going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll be speaking with Sophie Mann Shafir from the Provincetown Independent. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup. On The Point, we're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Eve Zuckoff. There's a growing hope on the Outer Cape that a mostly Jamaican congregation that meets at the chapel on the pond in North Truro might be able to keep their worship space. Sophie Mann Shafir of the Provincetown Independent has all the details. Sophie, welcome to the News Roundup.
Thanks for having me, Eve.
Sophie, before we get into the fundraising efforts to support this congregation, can you briefly talk about the background on this story? The owners, the property itself, set the stage.
Yeah, so the Chapel on the Pond is a colonial revival style chapel that is really beautiful and historic, built in 1915. It was previously a Catholic church, and the current property owners bought it in 2009. And the current congregation has been worshiping there since 2017, so for about 7 years, and it's led by Pastor David Brown, who is Jamaican, and his congregation, which he's grown from what he found, which was, you know, about four or five, just a handful of parishioners, to what it is now, which is well over 50, is also mostly Jamaican, and the property owners, who are not based in Truro, they're based in Colorado, and also travel, are kind of lead a traveling ministry, are often not here. And they gave notice to Pastor Brown earlier this year in January that the property was going to be, quote, prayerfully repurposed, and that the congregation would have to vacate.
And they wanted to sell it for $1.5 million, which this congregation did not have. But since then, a substantial anonymous donation has kicked off kind of a grassroots fundraising campaign. What kind of money is behind this effort?
Yeah, so the money is coming from, so far, most of the money is coming from an anonymous donor who has pledged $500,000 and is willing to match up to another $500,000 in community donations. The sort of contingency on that donation is that it would be going through the Truro Conservation Trust, which has agreed to acquire the property, or try and acquire the property, once it's listed, which is likely to be April 1st. And there would be a sort of long-term lease to the current congregation led by Pastor Brown and his Emmanuel Faith Ministry under that sort of agreement, in which the congregation would be responsible for paying utility and maintenance costs. And it's a specific kind of agreement that the trust currently has going with another arts organization in Truro called Castle Hill, and it's been working well there. The lease would be for $1 a year. With the understanding that the congregation would be responsible for sort of maintenance and upkeep. But part of the complication here is that the congregation hasn't actually been taking in any, you know, funds or offerings. That's all been going to management.
Right.
So this fundraising campaign is sort of all hands on deck. There's a GoFundMe going that, as of this morning, had about $31,500, which is, you know, going to be matched. And then in direct donations to the trust, there's been, as of a couple of days ago, about $38,000, which puts the total over about $640,000, which is, you know, on its way to the goal.
And you all have information about the GoFundMe on your website, Provincetown Independent. Remind us, what's the timeline to make sure they can keep this worship space?
So the timeline so far, it seems that the property is going to be listed on April 1st. That's what property owner Bob Vello has said in a text to campaign organizers. The current congregation has to vacate by the end of March, and then the property is likely to be listed on April 1st. And so the clock is ticking in terms of fundraising, in that they're hoping for $1.5 million by April 1st. And again, you know, there's not certainty as to what the list price will be. But there's a couple big events planned for today and tomorrow. One is at the Commons in Provincetown today at 5:30 p.m., sort of a community food, music, Q&A with organizers and people from the congregation and the Conservation Trust.
Hmm. Sophie, I want to switch gears. We've got about 30 seconds left here, which is not fair. I'm sorry to do this to you for this size of a story, but I want to get one more in really quickly. It has to do with short-term rentals and efforts to kind of limit them through town bylaws on the Outer Cape. Can you give us a quick sense of what these bylaws are targeting?
Yeah, so the bylaws are targeting short-term rentals and limiting them to, in Truro and East Ham, it would be 2 per owner. Truro is has drafted language to grandfather in a third for people who already have 3 or more, and then also banning fractional ownership of properties, which include real estate basically shared by several parties where the shares have been advertised and sold on the open market with costs distributed among them.
Sophie Manchefier, thank you for kind of giving us that primer. Again, there's a lot more on the Provincetown Independence website. Sophie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Eve.
It has been a busy week on Beacon Hill, and CAI's Dan Tritel spoke with our State House correspondent, Katie Lannon, about all the activity. Here's their conversation.
Hey, good morning.
State health officials are deep into budget talks this week. Part of those talks involve preparing for an aging population in Massachusetts. What does this mean broadly for the healthcare system?
Yeah, if you look at it big picture, as people get older, they're more likely to need various services in healthcare and other services to address their personal needs. It also means more people are retiring at a time when there's already a workforce shortages impacting healthcare broadly. So that is a crunch as you have more demand and fewer people to provide services. The Executive Office of Health and Human Services makes up more than half the state budget. So it's a piece of the pie that lawmakers look at quite closely for where they're spending and where they could be saving. The Healey administration is proposing some cuts to eligibility for MassHelp's personal care attendant program that helps people with daily living activities. So that's something we're really seeing budget writers and lawmakers zeroing in on, and if that's the best way to maintain services for people who need them, or if there are other approaches the state should be looking at.
What else did state lawmakers hear from the Health and Human Services Secretary, who testified at the State House this week?
One thing that the Health and Human Services Secretary Kate Walsh flagged under questioning from lawmakers is that there are more of an uptick in data breaches affecting the healthcare industry, some of which she said are very scary. She sees that as something that, you know, has the potential to erode trust between patients and their providers that they go to for sensitive situations. And that's something that technology and health officials at the state level are keeping their eye on, and something lawmakers are interested in maybe pursuing some additional reforms around. Of course, there's a number of areas lawmakers are interested in health reforms to make the system work better for people and for the state budget.
Meanwhile, the November election isn't far off. Right now, state lawmakers looking at asking voters whether the minimum wage should go up for people working for tips in Massachusetts. What's the latest on this proposal?
Yeah, lawmakers held a hearing this week to delve into a proposed ballot question that would replace the lower minimum wage for tipped workers with the state's full $15 minimum wage over a period of several years. Supporters say it's a way to improve working conditions and make sure folks in the restaurant industry don't have to put up with harassment and unfair treatment to get those tips. But, you know, there are plenty in the industry who say the system works well and that as it is, and that the current system lets bartenders, servers bring in a good income with themselves. So lots to decide potentially this November if that makes it all the way to the ballot.
And a story that's been getting a lot of coverage this week, Governor Healey announced a blanket pardon for people convicted of marijuana possession before it was legalized in Massachusetts. So tell us more about this, and do you know how many people this will affect?
We haven't been able to get hard numbers from the Healey administration, but the governor says it will affect hundreds of thousands of people. Anyone with a misdemeanor marijuana possession conviction from a Massachusetts court on their record, and that it is something that will need to be approved by the governor's council, a panel of elected officials that vets pardons. Generally, the counselors seem to be supportive of it, and if they do sign off, this will take effect automatically. People won't need to go through the whole process with the court system like they might if they were seeking to expunge a charge from their record. So it's something that Healey and her team say will remove barriers for people and help them get jobs, housing, whatever they might need that a past marijuana conviction has been an obstacle for.
Katie Lannon is our Statehouse correspondent. She reports from Beacon Hill. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Statehouse correspondent Katie Lannon, again speaking with CAI's Dan Treidel. Electric aviation could be coming to the Cape. A fully electric aircraft was at Joint Base Cape Cod for a recent demonstration. CAI's Brian Engels was there and joins us now. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Eve.
Brian, tell us about this aircraft. Who is developing it and why was it at the base?
Yes, so it's called ALIA. It's being developed by the Air Force and a Vermont-based aerospace company called Beta. It's 100% battery powered. The only fluid is brake fluid. No fuel at all. It's kind of similar in size to a small passenger plane, about a 50-foot wingspan. One of the things that was really cool about getting to see it land at the base was how quiet it was. Since it's fully electric, there's no engine noise. The only thing making noise is the propeller at the back of the aircraft. I spoke with flight test engineer Ross Elcourt. He says mid-flight in the cockpit, the crew's able to have conversations just at the level we're having right now. No need for headsets or shouting. You know, The Air Force has been developing this for potential use in rescue missions or cargo missions. Elcourt said that he and the rest of the roadshow crew, as they're called, they were at the base on Friday for this demonstration so that base officials could see how ALIA works and ask the crew some questions.
But what is the base, Joint Base Cape Cod, thinking about using this technology for?
Yeah, so I did speak with the executive director at the base, retired Brigadier General Christopher Foe. He says officials were exploring ideas like using ALIA to drop off medical supplies or food and some potential for using it in the surrounding community as well. He mentioned a hypothetical where a generator might need to be fixed. Maybe it could take an hour to drive out there, but that ALIA could get a team there in 5 minutes. Foe says the base is excited about the potential for this. Part of the appeal is that you can use this smaller aircraft to deliver a lighter package instead of tying up like a big plane or a helicopter. And Foe said that ALIA's flight from New Hampshire to the Joint Base, it only costs about $10 in charging costs, while a military helicopter like a Black Hawk, you know, that can cost thousands of dollars per hour to operate.
And is this right that it charges up the same way an electric vehicle does?
Yeah, that is right. So the flight test engineer, Elcourt, he says that ALIA uses the same kind of fast charger that can power an EV in under an hour. The developer, Beta, has been working with the Armed Forces and MassDOT to expand the charging network in Massachusetts. So we could potentially be seeing more of these things flying around.
Okay. Well, moving on to another story you reported this week, there's been a rise in colon cancer cases among younger people. And you spoke to a local doctor who weighed in on what could be behind this trend.
Yeah, that's right. I spoke with Dr. Aaron Dickstein about this. He's a gastroenterologist with Cape Cod Healthcare. He says that people who are in their 30s now have a 2 to 4 times increased risk of developing colon cancer compared to people who are in their 70s. So he says there's a lot of research happening in the field right now about this trend. And right now, experts aren't exactly sure why they're seeing these numbers climb in younger people. But Dickstein did have some information from a few studies, and he says that right now, those studies show that obesity could be a factor, more sedentary lifestyle, eating red meat and processed meat, those might all be factors. And with the higher risk for younger people, Dickstein says that the guidance for the age when people should get their first colonoscopy has dropped to 45, where that number used to be 50. And that age could be even younger for people if they have a family history of the disease.
Wow. Okay. Did he have any guidance for what people can do to lower their risks?
Yeah. So preventative screening was the big one. But as far as other things people can do is Be physically active, eat more fruits and vegetables. He says some studies show that garlic can be particularly helpful in lowering risk here, and that there's some data that taking baby aspirin might actually help lower risk too.
Okay, none of these things are terribly unfamiliar when giving health advice on the radio.
Yeah.
You cover regional government for the station as well. Barnstable County recently awarded some state grants to local farmers. What was unique about this program?
So part of the requirement was that some of the recipients for these grants had to be socially disadvantaged farmers. So this money, it was around $750,000 of state funds that went out locally. And the director of the county's Cape Cod Cooperative Extension, Mike McGuire, he spoke about the program at a recent commissioners meeting, and he says that Tony Andrews Farm in Falmouth was one of the awardees, and that farm was also recently featured in a newsletter from the state that was recognizing Black farmers. It talked about how Tony Andrews faced discrimination after he started his farm, trying to sell strawberries that were grown on the Cape up in Boston, and that Andrews would either get lower prices for his fruit or he would get turned away from the market altogether. Andrews died about 20 years ago. His son took over operations of the farm after. And McGuire from the county, he says that the farm being part of this program is an example of learning from past mistakes and making sure that the food distribution system is more inclusive. As far as how this money is going to go out, the county buys food from these 8 local growers, and then that food gets distributed to schools on the Cape, food pantries here, and service groups.
And the extension says that they're trying to make sure that the local food distribution network is culturally sensitive. What does that mean? How have they been doing that?
Right. So two of the groups that are part of this grant program, they're faith-based groups, and they serve immigrant populations who may have different needs for food. The extension's horticulturalist has worked with these groups to set up their gardens and help them grow food that's culturally appropriate. McGuire says that local food pantries say it's been a challenge to make sure that people who are new to the region have food that's traditionally found in their countries, and that the food distribution network here on the Cape, trying to keep that sensitivity in mind kind of as things move forward.
And the county has had some news from its wastewater division this week, too, that you've been reporting on. The Massachusetts Alternative Septic System Test Center, which is located here on the Cape, is planning to expand. Why are they looking to grow their operation?
Yeah, so the center's on the front line of a lot of wastewater research, and they're looking for some new facilities to keep doing that work. You know, as CAI's reported, wastewater is a huge issue for the region. Nitrogen pollution, new state regs on septic systems, massive sewer projects. All this going on, the test center has been exploring things that could help. Urine diversion, alternative systems that use wood chips to get nitrogen out of the environment. And so this $1.7 million expansion, it would provide more space for research, and it would set up a new clean water center. That building would offer public outreach and train wastewater workers on some of these new technologies.
And in the next 30 seconds here that we've got left, you have also reported that there's some buy-in for this project because some universities in Massachusetts would be able to research at this new facility.
Yeah, so the expansion would include a new wet lab. With the current space maxed out, this new lab would give schools a chance to do experiments on live wastewater. That's something that's not necessarily easy to do in an academic space where the test center is already all set up for it. Mm-hmm. And having that opportunity for universities to come do research here is something that makes this grant application much stronger. And so we'll see now if this state agency that funds technology projects, whether or not they'll fund this expansion.
Mm. Brian Engels of CAI, thank you so much.
Thank you, Eve.
And that is our show for today. I want to thank my guests, CAI's Jeanette Barnes, Brian Engels, and Katie Lannon, Jason Graziadei of the Nantucket Current, Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette, Anastasia Lennon of the New Bedford Light, Sophie Mann Shafir of the Provincetown Independent, and thank you to Dan Treidel for engineering this program. You may have heard his voice all morning edition too. It's been a long shift and he is amazing. Steve Junker will be back next week and he will let me retreat to the safety of reporting in Woods Hole. I'm Eve Zukoff. Thank you for listening.